Welcome to In Conversation With from Devon Chamber, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, the podcast from the Devon Chamber of Commerce, kindly supported by our good friends, Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. My name is Paul Philpott. I'm Vice Chair of the Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and I'm also, for my sins, Director of Devon Chamber. Now, we're aiming to interview many of our local Devon-based MPs this season. We've already spoken to Luke Pollard of Labour, and now we move across the region to South Devon, where their first ever Liberal Democrat MP is Caroline Vodin. Hello, Caroline. Welcome to the studio.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for travelling down. We were actually just saying, those that we know in business and friends and colleagues around the country don't actually realise quite how big Devon is. So when it comes from, oh, can you just pop down to this part of Devon, it can be a bit of a jaunt, can't it? Which I can imagine has been rather logistically hard for you because you're still doing your summer tour.
I am. I'm aiming to visit 50 towns and villages across my constituency over the summer recess.
Yeah.
I think I've got nearly 500 square miles of territory. Haven't worked it out exactly.
See, it does add up, doesn't it?
But it is one of the biggest. And yeah, it's a real challenge to always be where you're needed. And, you know, there's a lot of diary planning going on to make sure that we organise events in the same corner of the constituency.
Yeah.
So we don't waste too much time driving around. But yeah, it's been great reaching the furthest corners of the constituency.
Yeah, well, we'll no doubt talk about that in a bit more detail. Now, as I mentioned in my intro, you made history in 2024 by becoming the first Liberal Democrat MP for South Devon, ending a century, it says here, of Conservative representation. Now, that must have felt like quite a win. Obviously, all's fair in love and war, and we're apolitical at the Chamber. But when you move in and you become MP and taken over after such a long run, that must have felt great.
It felt amazing. It was 102 years of a Conservative MP elected in the constituency. Obviously, there was a very short period where Sarah Wollaston, one of my predecessors, switched sides from the Conservatives to the Liberal Democrats, but then she lost her seat. But to be elected as a Liberal or a Lib Dem, first in 102 years. So it felt really amazing on election night. We thought we might do it. We knew there was a chance, but we weren't complacent. So to win with such a solid majority was just brilliant.
I think this is it. I can imagine you don't actually know until you know.
No, you can think you know, but many people have been caught out by that.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful. You know, you're always managing your expectations. And as somebody who's not standing for re-election, but going into it as a newbie, it's quite difficult because you know that if you do win, your entire life will change. But you can't actually start planning for that because you might not win.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to make too many plans because that would be awful if you then had to unravel them. So we spent quite a long time saying, well, maybe if, you know, what if, let's not think about it too much just in case it doesn't happen, you know, and then suddenly you have 48 hours basically to sort your life out and pack a case and you're off.
Is it really? Just because, I mean, I've kind of gathered that from talking to other MPs. Literally, you're like not an MP, then you suddenly are an MP and things within a matter of minutes start to get proper serious.
Yeah. So the way it worked was I found out about 5:30 in the morning, had an email from the Liberal Democrats saying there'll be a Zoom call Friday evening for everybody who's won. So, you know, you try and get a little bit of sleep, but of course you've been up all night. You try and get some sleep, but you can't because your adrenaline's racing.
Yeah.
We had a Zoom call where they gave us some information and said you have to be at Lib Dem HQ by 9:30 on Monday morning. And you ring this number to get a hotel sorted out. So there's a travel office. But of course, the travel office had 400 plus new MPs mm-hmm. who all needed hotels. And so that was a bit of a bun fight. Yeah. And being in Devon, obviously had to be on the train on Sunday because I couldn't get there in time on Monday morning.
Of course, yeah.
So by Sunday afternoon, that was it, you know, without really any sleep. And then you head to London. And then it all starts. And on Monday, it was like the first day at a new school. There were hundreds of people wandering around, all completely lost. Nobody knew where they were going. Nobody knew what they were doing. And we had this kind of fresher's fair for new MPs. So we followed it around and got our laptop and got our security chat and so on and so on.
This is the real world of being an MP. It's kind of
and
like arriving
the
there getting lost
you
every morning.
Get into your inbox, you've got 500 emails because from the moment you're elected, people have started emailing me saying, you know, now you're my MP. I want you to sort this out. So
I can imagine.
It starts on
it's
day one.
A shock to the system, I bet.
Yeah, but very exciting. You know, you're carried along on a wave of adrenaline and excitement for a good couple of weeks mm-hmm. until you realise how tired you are. And
yeah. Cool. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So your background includes leading Devon Rape Crisis and Sexual Abuse Services. Now, how has that role shaped your priorities when it comes to Westminster?
Well, I think being the chief executive of a charity like that, which does a lot of its work on a commissioned basis from the government, is gives you quite an insight into the other end of the pipeline, if you like. So now I'm sitting in Westminster talking about funding and arguing for more funding for organisations because I've been at the hard end, knowing how hard it is to run an organisation that is funded by the Ministry of Justice mainly and the Police and Crime Commissioner. And the funding is being cut. They've lost a third of their funding. So I'm sitting there listening to the Labour Minister for Women and Equalities or Safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips saying, you know, this government is going to halve violence against women and girls over the next 10 years. But at the same time, I know that the organisation I used to run has now closed its helpline and closed its waiting list because its funding's been cut by a third. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. So I think having that experience of being in the real world, running an organisation like that, means that you have real world knowledge of the effects of decisions that are made in Westminster, which I think is helpful. You know, being in a leadership role is helpful because as an MP, you have a team of staff that you have to manage. And, you know, if you've never been a manager before, that's an added stress to an already stressful job. And you can see that MPs who have never managed staff before do sometimes struggle with it, because you have to be a leader, you also have to be a manager, you know, and keep your team together. So I would say that Rape Crisis was quite a difficult environment to work in. I joined them during the pandemic year, so November 2020. So I think we were sort of between lockdowns, but we went into another lockdown. So most of us were working from home. It was a really, really challenging time for the organisation because they tried to keep going, but their staff didn't have the camaraderie of being in an office. They were all working from home. So it was really difficult. And I think that is just really good experience to be managing a team in a stressful environment and learning how hard that is and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, so that's helped. And I guess that focus on women's issues, working in the women's sector, has definitely meant that I'm more alive to those issues in Parliament. I've joined a couple of APPGs, one on domestic violence, and spoken up for victim support in the House of Commons, because I think it gets a bit of a short straw.
Yeah, because I guess in many different ways, you're not a, I kind of hate this term, but you know it applies to many politicians. You're not a career politician, are you? You bring real world experience and you're applying that in your role, which I think just adds a much more important, realistic, down to earth dimension.
I would agree. I mean, I'm 56. I was elected at 55. That, you know, that's a lot of professional experience, you know, 35 years of working in different sectors. I think it really helps when you're an MP because you have experience of the real world. You know what people are talking about. You know what it means to be out there, not just earning a living, but dealing with all the difficult things about running a business or having a job or being a parent. You know, I've got some colleagues who are very young and they're amazing and they're energetic. They've got a lot more energy than me and they can keep going and the stamina and everything, but they don't have the same life experience. And I'm not saying they're not going to be good MPs, but I definitely think that the life experience I've had has really helped me arrive at decisions, to know what I think about, how I feel about things, what I believe in, what's important to me, to have a perspective on life that I certainly didn't have at 26.
Yeah. I read in your biography, and it's a fact that I find quite exciting, that you began your career as a Reuters journalist, freelance editor and business owner in Totnes. So you've worked in global newsrooms, SMEs, local businesses. So you must be able to bring elements of communication and engagement to your role. How have you been able to deploy those skills?
Well, I think it's a really useful background to have. So I was a journalist probably for about 15 years. I worked for Reuters for 10 of those years. And, you know, I've interviewed lots of politicians in my time.
So you can say to somebody who's giving you a hard time, don't you give me a hard time, because I used to be where you are.
Yeah, and I'm not scared of the media because I know who they are and how they work and what they're looking for.
Yeah.
But I think it means that you have an ability to go into a situation that you might not know very much about, ask the right questions, really listen to the answers, not only what somebody's telling you, but what they're not telling you. Mm-hmm. You know, it definitely helps, that kind of inquiring mind that you have to have as a journalist. The speed, you know, Reuters was all about speed because we were a wire service, so we had to be first, but we also had to be accurate. So I have really high standards about speed and accuracy. And, you know, I want everything done immediately because that's just how I was trained to do it. You know, I'm good at note taking, which really helps.
Don't tell me you can do shorthand.
I can do shorthand, can you? But I can't do it very fast anymore. I do a real mixture now of normal writing with a few words I can remember in shorthand. I used to be quite good. But yeah, I had my own business on Totnes High Street for 5 or 6 years. And, you know, I'll be completely honest, it wasn't a massively successful business financially, but we had a fantastic time and we were a really key part of the high street and lots of people really valued what we did. And I know how hard it is to run a high street business and make a living from it. And I can see what the challenges are. So that really helps being able to speak to other people doing that job because I have some inkling of what they're up against.
Yeah. When you're seeing other MPs being interviewed on TV and they're being grilled, they're being pressed on figures, and perhaps they haven't rehearsed or researched the figures, do you not get sometimes frustrated when they don't say, I just don't know the answer? One thing that winds me up is when people who are being interviewed go round and round and round and round and round, either avoiding the question and coming out with some typical statement or making it up rather than just admitting, which we all need to do every now and then, I'm really sorry, I don't know, because there's no harm in admitting you don't know. As a former journalist, it really frustrates you.
I think honesty is always the best policy. Yeah. And I think people don't like listening to constantly avoid answering the question. You know, and we all have our talking points. Every party has talking points. You know, they have what the thing they want you to get across if you're being interviewed about a certain subject, you know, and that's understandable. But I've always tried to be really genuine when I'm being interviewed. And if I didn't know something, I would be far more likely to say I don't know than just to try and avoid the question. Because like you say, you know, we're all human. And if you don't know the figures, then you might have forgotten the figures.
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably okay to say so.
Fair enough. Because when you're on the spot with all the lights, it can get to you a bit.
And it is very, very different being on this side of the table. Mm. You know, even having spent years on your side of the table, it does feel different being the one who's being grilled.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm pleased I don't actually have to be grilled every now and then.
Especially with social media, because you know anything can be clipped and taken out of context.
This is it,
and
isn't
shared.
It?
So you say something on a phone-in show on LBC, for example. Mm. Somebody who's listening can clip that and put it out there.
And context is everything.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to take something out of context and misuse it and abuse the message. Have you been a victim of that kind of social media? Because I know some MPs who have really had a nasty time. Unfairly so. I don't think we have enough respect for people that are doing that as a role.
No, the only time something was taken out of context was when I was trying to intervene on one of the reform MPs in the chamber. And I had tried several times to stand up and say, would the honourable member give way?
Yeah.
And the courtesy thing is that you do give way if somebody wants to intervene. You don't have to, but if somebody has persistently tried to intervene, then normally you would just say, yes, I'll give way. And then they can say something and then they sit down again. It is supposed to be a debate. So I had tried to intervene several times on one of them and he had consistently refused to let me stand up and speak. And I rolled my eyes because I was frustrated that I wasn't being allowed to speak. And that was immediately clipped and put on Twitter as me rolling my eyes at what he was saying.
Right. So entrepreneurs and business leaders listening in, what do you see as, you know, the South Devon's biggest opportunities for growth in the next few years? Because I think we've got so much opportunity and capability down here.
Well, I'd like to think that there's opportunities with green tech and green skills and the green transition, because I think we're quite passionate about that down here. And I think renewable energy is something that we all want to see more of. So it would be nice to think that we could use particularly Plymouth and some of the manufacturing and ideas and tech. And over in Paignton as well, there's quite a lot of tech going on there. So it would be great to think that we could use those skills to support the green transition. The leisure industry and obviously hospitality, there's massive growth potential there. But I think growth here is hampered by two things. So primarily connectivity.
Yes.
If we want investment to come down here, then we need better road and rail connectivity and we need much better digital connectivity. And you mentioned my village tour. The thing that has consistently come up more than anything else over the last 2 or 3 weeks is broadband and mobile signal. Some people can't even make a mobile phone call from their village, you know, let alone connect to high-speed broadband. And it's just shocking that in the 21st century, you can connect to the internet from the middle of the Sahara Desert, but you can't from a village near
Big Creek. You go to Eastern Europe and get like gigabit broadband for like 2 pence a month. Well, it isn't 2 pence a month, but you know what I mean, comparatively.
Yeah, absolutely. And they keep talking about how they're not going to put fibre broadband to every premises because it's not going to be commercially viable. Well, we have to look at a satellite solution in that case, or a different way of doing it. You know, it is the 21st century. We should be able to find a way. So I'm really frustrated by that. And I think it's holding us back because I think, you know, the South Hams and Devon in general is a beautiful place for people to want to relocate, who may be running their own business or want to start something up, you know, an SME. But they're not going to do that in a place where they can't get a reliable broadband connection. So that's really important. And the second thing is, I think if we want growth, the government has made some really poor decisions in the last 12 months. You know, I was really hoping that we would have a change with the new government coming in, but particularly their decisions around the national insurance hike on small businesses. Every single day I hear businesses say to me that this is stopping them hiring, it's stopping them growing, it's stopping them investing. We spoke to somebody this morning who said the cost on his business is the same as opening a new restaurant. It's just massive. And then on top of that, you've got the minimum wage hike. But we all know that that doesn't just mean minimum wages. That's every wage above the minimum wage, because you have to maintain the differentials, and lowering the threshold from 9,500 a year to 5,000 a year. So particularly in a seasonal economy, you know, you might have lots of staff in a pub, for example, or a restaurant working over the summer who wouldn't earn 9,500. So you wouldn't have to pay any national insurance, but they will earn 5,000. And suddenly you're going to have to pay £1,000 per staff member for the summer.
Yes. Yeah.
So all of those things combined are really hitting an economy like ours, which is very dependent on hospitality and small and medium-sized businesses, which is hampering growth. And we've also seen businesses and farms saying to us that they're not investing in the business because of the inheritance tax thing, which is frightening a lot of people. They don't want to make the business more valuable because that increases the liability of it going into inheritance tax. There are so many decisions that have been made over the last 12 months, which I think are really hampering growth.
And the chain reaction of consequences as a result.
The consequences are huge. Yeah.
You definitely seem to take on board the pain points of SMEs. I mean, you've just listed quite a good number of examples. What are the things of SME business owners shared with you?
Well, like I say, a lot of them have talked about national insurance, VAT. You know, hospitality businesses would love to see a cut in VAT. And I'm the vice chair of the hospitality all-party parliamentary group. So I work a lot with Hospitality UK. That is one of their calls, because obviously they had a lower business rate relief and that was changed. So, you know, they get less benefit from that now. There's just an awful lot of things piling up against small businesses, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your high street businesses that are threatened by online retailers who seem to have a pretty unfair crack at the whip. You know, they're not paying their taxes
and business rates.
You know, the Liberal Democrats would like to see far more focus paid on getting tax receipts from the internet giants, social media tech companies, the online gambling companies, you know, all those people who are making so much money and not really paying their fair share. And then you've got your high street businesses that are struggling with rent and rates and low footfall, and a population that has less money in their back pocket and aren't out spending so much.
But also similarly, within the area that you're covering, within our area, you obviously have to take on board the troubles and concerns of private individuals. You know, anything we were saying earlier in the other studio before coming in to record, you know, on one hand, you've got somebody moaning about refuse collections. I say moaning, I use the term moaning, but you know, having a comment about refuse collections. And then on another side, you have somebody who perhaps has issues about where to park their yacht. That's quite a diverse range of inquiries, issues, concerns. You're a sounding board as an MP, aren't you? People come to you and they literally just land in your lap expecting some magic.
Yeah, I do wish I had a magic wand.
Yeah.
It's difficult because there are things you want to resolve and you just know that it's going to be really, really difficult. I think one of the things that has really struck me is the difference between rural and urban. You know, we have a government with a cabinet that is almost entirely urban. They have urban constituencies. And I just think there's a real lack of understanding about rural Britain and how it works. And, you know, like you were talking about the wider effect of changes, if the farmers aren't investing, then, you know, the guys who are going to build their new tractor shed are not going to build it. And the guy who was going to sell them a tractor doesn't sell them a tractor. And so it goes on. So the rural economy is really interdependent. And I think there's a lack of understanding about how difficult it is to get from A to B. how the impact that poor rural transport makes, particularly on young people, for them to get a Saturday job, for them to go and do an apprenticeship, for them to do after school activities. You know, so a lot of our kids will travel to school on the school bus, and the school bus leaves at the end of the school day. Now, if that pupil wants to go and do a football club or a choir or whatever after school, they can't get home because the school bus has gone. And for any child whose parents don't have a car or they're out at work, they can't get home after an after-school activity. So that immediately makes their world smaller. It cuts off those opportunities. So there are so many examples I could give of the impact of poor rural transport. And yet the government is investing millions in railways in the north of England. I mean, multiple millions. And it wouldn't take millions to improve a bus service because buses are much, much cheaper than trains. But they just don't see it as a necessity to subsidise bus transport. So I think I'm digressing. You were talking about the wide variety of issues I have to deal with. I mean, yes, I have very rich, very wealthy.
MP stroke agony aunt,
I think. Yeah, people get frustrated. They get frustrated with everything and they see you as a conduit for their frustration and somebody who can help sort things out. And we do. And we've had some really brilliant successes. And sometimes somebody will have been struggling with an issue for years and then the MP writes a letter and suddenly it gets resolved. And I find that quite annoying because I think if you can resolve it when a letter's landed on your desk with an MP letterhead, you could have resolved it for your customer.
Much earlier, yeah.
But that feels really good to be able to resolve individual issues. And we've had some really good wins. But there's a lot of things that you know that you just can't resolve quickly. And that is hard. You sort of take a lot of that on board.
But it's the reality of it, isn't it, at the end of the day.
The Devon Business Show is back. Devon Chamber is bringing the Southwest's largest business event back to Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday, the 15th of October, connecting hundreds of businesses and entrepreneurs with future clients all under one roof. With over 125 exhibitors, interactive stands, live podcasts, a networking hub, and guests from across the city and the county, this is the not-to-be-missed date for your diaries. There are many ways to get involved, including a launch party on the 1st of July, where you can enjoy a cocktail and canapés at Tinside Lido overlooking the Sound. Plus, our pre-show networking breakfast at Home Park's Mayflower Grandstand on the day. A limited number of stands are available. Book yours now at devonchamber.co.uk. The Devon Business Show at Plymouth Life Centre on Wednesday the 15th of October. Let's get working at networking.
Now, you've spoken openly about being widowed young and about the work that you've done with the Way charity, which is widowed and young. Are you able to share a little bit more about that and also how that experience shaped yourself as a leader and your general approach to life?
Yeah, so I was 34 when my first husband died of esophageal cancer. Mm-hmm. So he'd been ill for a year and our children when he died were 3 and 17 months. So the little one was very, very young when he was diagnosed. And it's quite a brutal experience to go through. People don't die in their 30s generally.
No, I mean, that's
He was a little bit older. He was 42. I was 34. And I think it shapes everything about your life from then on, really. I mean, it feels like nothing could ever be as bad as that was. I imagine losing a child would be worse. And, you know, let's pray that never happens.
Of course, absolutely.
But I suppose it kind of removes the fear. My mantra is always, well, what's the worst that can happen? You know, you stand for election, you lose an election, you do an interview, it goes badly wrong. Nobody's died. And when somebody you love has died and you've been through it and survived and come out the other side, then actually nothing's really that scary. So I think, you know, from that point of view, it's great because you just think, you know, there's a resilience there. When you come through that, you realise that you are resilient and you do eventually bounce back and it's okay.
So it's empowered you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's a really good message to give, I think, to anybody who's been through
such... I mean, I'd rather it hadn't happened.
No, of course. Absolutely, of course. But it's so easy to go into shutdown.
Yeah, and I think I probably did. You know, it was a really, really difficult time. You know, Nick died on a Monday morning and the kids came home from nursery that afternoon. And at 7 o'clock on Tuesday morning, I was woken up by the kids and I was a single mother. You know, I didn't have time to grieve because suddenly I was a single mother of two toddlers, basically. So It's really tough. And that's why I got involved with Widowed and Young and made loads of friends who were in the same boat. And we had a ball. You know, we used to go away for the weekend. We would generally go to caravan parks because it was cheap. You know, we'd rent loads of vans. We'd get there on the Friday night. The kids would very quickly run around the playground until they were exhausted. Then they'd end up in a caravan, all ages, you know. So my Laura was 2, 3 maybe, and the oldest might have been 15. They're all in there together, you know, the little ones watching completely unsuitable television and the mums and dads all in another van with a bottle of wine.
Good.
just trying to get through, you know, just trying to survive. And yeah, those weekends were very, very memorable and absolutely life-saving because suddenly you're with a bunch of people who actually understand what you're going through.
And you did move on to sharing the experience in even more detail by writing a book as well, didn't you?
Yeah. So I wrote the book, it's called If There's Anything I Can Do, because that was the mantra that everybody, you know, if there's anything I can do, just let me know. The whole point of the book was it's really difficult when you're in that situation to let people know what you want them to do. It's really difficult to ask for help. It's difficult to repeatedly ask for help. You know, you might do it once, but you might not feel you could do it again. So the book was basically a practical guide to how can you help someone who has been through the worst experience. And it was not just about people who've lost a husband or wife, you know, somebody who's lost somebody else in their life and is grieving. And these are the practical things you can do that can really make a difference. So, you know, anything from like the next door neighbour coming around every Tuesday night to put the bins out for you so you don't forget. Or there was a lot of stuff about food, you know, because one of the things I found was I was suddenly eating every meal with 2 tiny children who frankly weren't much interested in eating anything other than fish fingers. That comes quite soul destroying after a while. So it was really nice if a friend would just appear and have some food with me. And, you know, you can't go out when you'd suddenly got these 2 small kids. You know, it's not like you can have a social life because suddenly you're a single parent, right? It's expensive.
Yeah, of course.
So there was lots of stuff around that. It's just about how to practically support someone. So household stuff, admin, food, socializing, paperwork, all the legal stuff. You know, there's lots of different ways that you can help depending on what you're good at, what you're not good at. And just don't be afraid to say, would you like me to do this for you? Because I can, like doing the gardening, you know, suddenly you have less time on your hands and there are things that don't get done.
And it's one less thing to worry about.
Yeah. And it was really well received. And over the years, I've had lots of feedback from people who've read it, who've said, this has been absolutely brilliant because I just didn't know what to do. And I think, you know, we don't deal with death very well in this country. We're scared of death.
Yes, this is true.
And we don't talk about it. And the friends who were the best were the friends who had personal experience of somebody close dying. The ones who had never really been through it with anyone just were completely at sea. They didn't know what to do. And I think when we addressed the assisted dying debate in Parliament, you know, it was really interesting that we were talking about dying in Parliament, and it's not something that happens very often. And there were people who were more comfortable with it than others.
Yeah, culturally, it's a conversation we tend to avoid.
Absolutely.
You know, but we don't like planning for death. We don't like...
We're all going to die. You know, it's not a surprise. So it shouldn't be so difficult for us to talk about it and to talk about what happens afterwards. And, you know, I have used my experience. I'm trying to get the law changed around what happens if you're widowed when pregnant, if you're not married, because currently you can't put your partner's name on the birth certificate without jumping through lots and lots of legal hoops. It's very difficult. It's costly. And it's a very small change that will affect not many people, but for those people it does affect, it will be significant. So I have used my experience already in the House of Commons and will continue to do so because I think it's really important to, you know, use all your experience to sort of inform your work.
So in terms of sharing tips, advice and experience, what advice would you give to other women in Devon, business leaders and entrepreneurs and females that are in the spotlight in the region? Because we're not in a truly equal society.
No,
I wish we were, but we're not. That's the reality of it. What would you say?
I think the most important thing is to not be afraid to step out of your comfort zone and just put yourself into situations that scare you, because you'll be really surprised what you're capable of. And you know, what's the worst that can happen? Everything's a learning experience.
You kind of have that as a mantra, don't you? You know, what's the worst that can happen?
Well, exactly. And if it doesn't go very well, you'll learn from it and you'll do it better next time. But I think it's really important to push yourself. you know, if you want to be a leader, if you want to get somewhere, then you absolutely have to do that. And you have to just believe that you can and take a step. And as soon as you've seen that you're capable of something, you'll take the next step. So I think that's really important. And I think also every woman needs to believe that they have as much right to be speaking in a room as the men, and quite often they don't, that your oxygen is just as important as everybody else's.
Imposter syndrome kind of thing.
Imposter syndrome is huge. And I've had imposter syndrome since being elected as an MP, and I know lots of my female colleagues have. I'm not sure many of the men have. I think there's a genuine belief that they deserve to be there and they're in their rightful place. Whereas I think for a lot of the women, some of the time they'll think, is this really me? And is this really happening? And do I deserve to be here? And
but that probably makes you more genuine, surely, you know, rather than having the kind of...
Probably, but it's an interesting approach, isn't it? That there are far fewer of us who think, yeah, I absolutely bloody well did deserve to be here and I'm in my rightful place and I don't have any doubt about it.
Yeah. But you can have a mix of the two, can't you? You can think, yeah, I've fought for this.
Yeah.
And then when you walk into the room or you stand up in front of people, you're like, oh my God, this is really happening.
Yeah,
now what it's like, all of a sudden it flips from confidence to imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and sometimes it is quite intimidating.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can be the best public speaker in the world, but when you're standing up in the House of Commons and the speaker's in a bad mood and, you know, it can be really intimidating.
Actually, earlier on, you know, when you mentioned about when you first got the role and you were given that induction, and is that when they teach you how to give way and do all the airs and graces that you kind of have in it?
Well, you have one.
It always makes me laugh. It's like, my word, just talk and bust in, but no, it's me. You say, stand up, sit down.
There's a session, a chamber session, right at the beginning on day two or three.
Yeah.
Where we all went in there as new MPs from all parties and were sort of taught how it all worked. But a lot of it you have to just absorb by watching. And the first few times you do it is terrifying because you're terrified of getting it wrong. It's one of those places where they don't really tell you what the rules are, but they sure as hell tell you when you get them wrong. It feels like a bit of a power play, you know.
Yeah.
You will be told if you break the rules, but you might not have known it was a rule. Because it's not a rule, it's a convention.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a really weird place.
Yeah.
But, you know, where you can and can't walk in the chamber. And that changes all the time, depending on who's speaking. So you have to be really aware of who's speaking, you know, the standing up, sitting down, and how you address people. You can get quite panicked about whether somebody is an honourable member or a right honourable member. Because obviously some of the more senior MPs are right honourable. But you kind of have to just know that. Because
I do not.
Nobody's wearing a badge, so
I couldn't do it. Yeah, that's for sure.
It's really weird.
I think the one thing that is definitely certain about being an MP is the uncertainty of it. You're kind of only in the seat for a certain period of time, and then I guess it's crikey, like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Here we go again.
Yeah, you've got to fight to retain your job.
Yeah, when you get to that stage of here we go again, what do you want to have achieved before you are up for that period of re-election?
Oh, well, in my wildest dreams, I would like to fix the broadband problem for the whole of South Devon. I'd like everybody to be able to get a dentist appointment.
Yep.
And I'd like all children with special educational needs and disabilities to have the education they deserve. I think I would really like to see some progress on rural issues. I'd like to join together with all my rural Lib Dem colleagues, and you know, we are doing this and we will continue to do it, and make enough of a fuss about things like investment in bus transport to really make a difference every day to people who need to get about. Dentistry we are pushing really hard on, and I think that will change, and I will fight hard for changes in Devon because we are in a dental desert. And working with colleagues at county level, you know, we had good results in May. The Lib Dems have taken over the county council. So I think between them and the Lib Dem MPs together, we're really going to try and improve things like, you know, the special educational needs situation, which is in the Devon part of my constituency. It's run by Devon, obviously. In the other half of my constituency, it's run by Torbay. I mean, part of that's about funding, but it's also about a change in approach. And I think that is changing. I think the fact that this government is talking about it, and the previous government never mentioned it or rarely mentioned it. So I think already there is a change in approach. I sit on the Education Select Committee. We're about to release a report in September on the changes we would like to see. So I will keep pushing for that because I think it's an area that is not only doing a massive disservice to the children who are affected, who have additional needs and disabilities, but it affects everybody in a school because the whole school environment needs to improve for all the children, and it needs to be more inclusive, but it needs to work. So it needs to work for the children who can be included and for all the other children who don't have additional needs. And there needs to be a way for them to work together. So yeah, I'm really going to push for changes in that. That's something I would like to see.
Good. I think one frustration that, rather it's just a fact of life, is that policy changes, investment, decision-making processes within the realms of government just take so long to flipping happen.
Yeah.
And all right, you might not get some of these things well and truly across the line, but at least you'll be part of that journey.
Yeah, for sure. And I think part of it is strong campaigning. You know, we have 72 MPs and are the biggest third party there's been for, you know, 100 years or something. So we're quite a strong voice together in Parliament, and there are things we want to see changed and things that
and
we will
some
campaign.
Issues as well. I mean, you know, talking to your peers and other parties in the region down here, you know, in the southwest, you do actually all get on quite well, which is really good, isn't it, for the region as a whole?
Yeah, and we all speak to each other, and across Devon, you know, I know most of the Devon MPs. There are a couple who I haven't got to know quite so well, but there are certain things that we are all committed to and that we all want to see change on. And yeah, it would be good to see us all sort of pulling together on some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, before I let you go, I need to ask you about something I discovered about you. And that is you once interviewed Bono in Sarajevo. So how did that come about? And what did you talk about with Bono in Sarajevo? I imagine this is going back to your Reuters days
So I had a job as the bureau chief of the Zagreb bureau in Croatia. So I lived there from 1997 to 99. And in 97, U2 came to do a concert in Sarajevo. And I was sent to Bosnia to cover it and to do the post concert interview with Bono. So in 1993, U2 were touring Europe and they did some live link ups with Sarajevo when it was under siege. And it was quite controversial, but they did these live link ups with people who were living under the siege because they'd been asked to try and draw attention to what was happening in Sarajevo. So they did that for a while. And then Bono promised that when the war was over, we'll come to Sarajevo and we'll do a concert. His bandmates were quite unhappy about it. He hadn't consulted them. There was a bit of chat about them doing a sort of charity gig. But Sarajevo said, no, if you're coming, we want the whole thing. We want the 40-foot lemon. We want, you know, we want the whole concert. We want to be
the
part of this
rig,
tour.
Yeah,
the full rig.
Yeah.
So Sarajevo sits in a bowl surrounded by mountains. And, you know, the place was destroyed, right? The roads were destroyed. The infrastructure was destroyed. But with the help of the United Nations Peacekeeping Force and the Bosnian president and a whole host of people, they took the whole shebang over the mountains into Sarajevo. And some of it came in on planes, I think military planes.
Yeah. Hercules type of thing.
Yeah. For the first time since the war, they took trains into Sarajevo from Bosnia and Croatia to bring fans to the concert. They waived all visa requirements for 24 hours. So they brought the fans in, they watched the concert, they slept in a big building that was next to the stadium. I can't remember what the building was. And they put them all on train the next day and took them out again. So there were Serbs, Croats and Muslims all there. There were thousands of peacekeeping troops in the stadium watching the concert. It was the most incredible night. It was incredible.
Sounds incredible.
And it was the first night of normality that any of these people had had for years and years and years. And it was just mind-blowing.
I can imagine.
And so afterwards, what did we talk about? We talked about the fact that he had no voice at all. And he would have cancelled that concert if it had been anywhere else. I mean, he was apparently going backstage and having cortisol injections or something to keep his voice going. But he was a mess. By the end of it, he wasn't singing at all. And the crowd was just singing. So we talked about that. We talked about the situation. We talked about Sarajevo. But we also talked about the fact that in the room with me, my Reuters camera crew were the two guys who had done the live link-ups from Sarajevo during the siege when U2 was, you know, elsewhere. And Bono didn't know that. So I introduced him to the cameramen. And yeah, there were lots of tears and it was very emotional. And they were pretty cross with me because they didn't want me to tell him.
Oh, my word.
But yeah, I remember it really clearly. And yeah, there was a lot of imposter syndrome there because I wasn't really up on my U2 facts and figures. And funnily enough, I have a second husband now who is probably one of the world's biggest U2 fans. And I told him that I'd interviewed Bono and I think we found a recording of it. And it was really quite embarrassing. He said, but you didn't ask him this and you didn't ask him that.
Yeah. But going back,
it's an amazing moment.
So those Reuters days, you obviously were quite front line then. I know you'd love what you do now, but do you kind of miss that a little bit?
Oh, I really miss it.
Yeah.
I really miss it. Yeah. So what happened was I ended up being the bureau chief in Croatia. youngest women bureau chief for Reuters. And I had spent quite a lot of time in the Balkans during the war, but not on the front line, not in Bosnia. I had spent a lot of time in Belgrade, in Serbia, doing a kind of editing role. The first time I went to Bosnia was just after the peace accords were signed. And I mean, it was quite hairy and there were lots of minefields around, but there wasn't frontline fighting. But I was there for a long time and then got pregnant and kind of had to come home because they wanted me to go and cover the Kosovo war, but I was pregnant and it was all...
You can't really do that, carrying a child.
Yeah, so it changed massively. And when I went back, I was kind of in the London office and we're talking 26 years ago. They were not very forward thinking and it was still quite male dominated. And I was kind of stuck in the corner because I'd gone and had a baby and it wasn't very helpful. And we can't just put you on a plane and, you know. So, yeah, I took a redundancy package and left. And, you know, looking back, I've often thought that was a bit hasty. But then I went on to do lots of other really exciting things. And obviously my life changed very radically a couple of years later anyway. Yes, so I probably would have left anyway. But it was a really exciting time,
Should always look forward.
Absolutely.
Look back with fond memories, but look forward with determination is what I say. Caroline Vodden, thank you very much for joining us today. Learned an awful lot about you. And yeah, I think you're the closest answer to Kate Adie I've ever met.
Well, it's been a lovely chatting.
If Kate Adie arrives, you leave, don't you? It's like the rule,
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, helping with all your business and personal taxation needs. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon Chamber and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.